Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisers, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he'd set up. Verse 4. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you're commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will be immediately thrown into a blazing furnace." Verse 8. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up?" Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hands, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. Verse 22, the king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, "Wasn't it 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed, their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command, and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god." Very simple question for you this morning. Is there anything you'd be prepared to die for? Or maybe not so simple. Maybe I'm being unfair, but I suspect one of the clearest evidences of the decadence which affects Western culture at the end of the 20th century is that for the vast majority of our men and women today, the answer to that question is no. There's nothing they'd be prepared to die for. Partly, I think it's the result of widespread disillusionment with idealism. The Vietnam War and Watergate scandals and so on have certainly left, I think, a whole generation of young Americans cynical about politics and politicians, radically questioning whether dying for your country is really so noble. Partly it's the consequence of our fear of the atom bomb, I think. The horrific aftermath of Hiroshima has led many in this post-war era to take the view that no tyranny is so morally objectionable that resistance to it justifies the risk of nuclear holocaust. Partly, I think it's due just to the general obsession of late 20th century men and women with running away from their own mortality. Fashions and cosmetics try and persuade us that we can look young forever. Aerobics classes and health foods encourage us to think we can stay fit forever. Retirement plans and pension funds encourage us to think we can enjoy ourselves forever. In fact, the whole game is a conspiracy to hide the inevitability of terminal decay from us, isn't it? One modern author has put it, death is the great human repression. Death is the universal neurosis. Death for modern man is muffled up in illusions. It's not difficult to see which society, riddled like that with subconscious fear of death, is not likely to be a breeding ground for martyrs, is it? But I think the main reason there are so few who are willing to die for a cause in our day is simply that most people do not have a cause to die for. They don't believe in anything with sufficient tenacity or confidence to warrant that kind of ultimate self-sacrifice. Ours is an age, as we've said so often, of toleration, in which all views are held to be equally valid. And of course, the corollary of that is that you can never tell anybody else they're wrong, nor ever be really sure you're right. In such an atmosphere of pluralism, commitment is essentially seditious. And martyrdom is indistinguishable from fanaticism. Anatole France expressed the modern mood perfectly when he says, to die for an idea is to set rather a high price upon conjecture. The point being, conjecture is all he believes modern man has. Maybe that's why those scenes last year in Tiananmen Square, or more recently in Romania, have been so moving for us. Those young protesters are so far removed from the quiescence that anesthetizes the spirit of most Western young people today. They have what we've lost, something they're prepared to die for. Yet even their stirring example isn't sufficient, is it, to deliver us from our own cultural anemia? Isn't it true to say that even while we're watching the pictures on the television screen, we find a nagging skepticism whispering in our ear? But is it really worth it? All that bloodshed and pain? Are they really going to be any better off at the end of the day for all those lives so bravely given? Is it really better to die on your feet than to live on your knees? Is it really worse to be red than dead? After all, Gorbachev will probably fall and the tanks roll back in. Even if they don't, are we in the West not just as politically alienated, just as materialistically discontent, just as spiritually impoverished as they are, for all our hard-won freedoms? Now, we may admire the heroism of those dissidents within the communist bloc, but it's a heroism I fear most of us can no longer aspire to ourselves. That's why Robert Maynard Hutchins recently observed, the death of Western democracy is not likely to be an assassination by ambush. It's much more likely to be a slow extinction, he predicts, from apathy, indifference, and undernourishment. If you think about it, no human being dies a martyr's death unless there is, at the very core of their being, a passionate commitment to a truth which they believe has unconditional claim upon their loyalty. In the absence of such commitment, moral heroism of any kind becomes impossible. In the absence of a belief in such absolute truth, demanding unconditional loyalty, we become what C.S. Lewis calls in one of his books, men without chests. We may have fine intellects, we may have highly developed artistic sensitivities, but we are people without virtue, people without guts, because only such a commitment can give us guts, can give us virtue. The tragedy of modern Western man is that he's run out of things he's prepared to die for. That's disastrous. For there is no middle ground, you see. We are all of us ultimately potential martyrs or potential suicides. The person who has nothing to die for is a person who also has nothing worth living for. Well, our Bible passage this morning invites us to decide which of those two categories we belong to. The story of three men with plenty of chest, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a story I'm sure many of us have been familiar with since childhood, and that may be a problem for us, because our association of this story with Sunday school may blunt our appreciation of its true seriousness. This is not a children's story. This is a very adult story dealing with very adult subjects. It's a story about political tyranny, about civil disobedience, about religious persecution, and supremely about martyrdom. Three men, three very adult men, who, unlike too many of us in Britain today, had something they were prepared to die for. And our task this morning is to identify what and why. Follow the story with me then. It's got three movements. The government that went too far, in verses 1 to 7. The dissidents who refused to conform, in verses 8 to 18. And the cause, which was worth dying for, in verses 19 to 30. When we have followed the story through those three movements, we'll ask ourselves what the relevance of this adventure is for us. First of all, then, the government that went too far. Look to the beginning of chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, we don't know for sure exactly what this golden image would have looked like. My own suspicion is that it might have resembled a gigantic totem pole, rather. The dimensions of verse 1 certainly indicate that it was unusually thin in proportion to its height. It must, I think, have had something of the pencil-like appearance of Cleopatra's needle, or something like that. We're not told whether it was carved in any way. The Aramaic word there, translated image, doesn't necessarily imply it was. It could have been just a blank vertical steel, a bit like that mysterious slab that features in Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, those of you who've seen it. But I think it's rather more likely that it was inscribed or shaped in some way, possibly in human form, like the famous Colossus of Rhodes. And indeed, it wasn't a great deal smaller than that famous Colossus. Whatever it looked like, however, this strange obelisk certainly represented something. It represented the emperor's pride. Do you notice how the narrator persistently keeps repeating, it was the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. That's what they seem to have called it. It didn't have any other name. The image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Indeed, a great many commentators speculate that the image may well have depicted the emperor himself. A replica even of that vast statue he'd seen in the dream that we were told about in chapter 2 and that we looked at last week. You are that head of gold, remember, Daniel had told Nebuchadnezzar. Now, could it be that Nebuchadnezzar was trying to make sure everybody knew it? For it's clear the worship of this image wasn't just an act of merely religious devotion. It was a public confession of political allegiance to the Babylonian Empire. That's why Nebuchadnezzar mustered this vast company of civil servants and foreign diplomats to its dedication. And that's why obeisance, you notice, was not just invited, it was commanded. The herald loudly proclaims, "This is what you're commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." Now, I think there's something undoubtedly comic to the Jewish eye and ear about this scene, which the narrator's portraying. And the narrator, I think, plays on that comedy in the way he keeps on reciting that long list of musical instruments. Do you notice in the story how he monotonously and quite unnecessarily repeats it again in verse 7 and then in verse 10 and then in verse 15? I can't escape the conclusion that he's being quite deliberately satirical. He's mimicking the elaborate magniloquence of the imperial herald, and he's inviting us to smile with him at the pretentiousness and the pomposity of this swaggering emperor. I mean, just think of the scene. Here he sits, Nebuchadnezzar, with his scepter in his hand, and he specially convened a court orchestra, permanently poised to perform their party piece whenever he waves his scepter in their direction. Meanwhile, there's this huge company of international dignitaries and VIPs milling around, waiting equally apprehensive for this orchestral cue, whereupon they all fall flat on their faces in feigned obeisance to this monumental folly the king has erected. What they were all saying under their breath, one daren't imagine. It was all most amusing, at least it was to the readers of the Book of Daniel. Idolatry was stupid in the minds of Jews at the best of times, and the prospect of this pagan emperor orchestrating the celebration of his own vanity in this way must have bordered on the farcical. But you can be sure that for those strict Jews who were actually there in Babylon, it was difficult to see the funny side. This golden colossus represented a serious problem for them. See, they had prospered in the Babylonian Empire only as a result of its enlightened attitude towards religious minorities. Babylon, like modern Britain in a way, was a cosmopolitan pluralist state. There was no established, or there was an established religion, but you didn't have to subscribe to it. So the Jewish exiles were free to maintain their loyalty to the God of the Bible and yet participate fully in civic life, and they did so. They were encouraged to do so by Jeremiah. We saw last week how four young men in particular had gained high office in the imperial hierarchy. Daniel was now a kind of head of the scientific civil service, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were regional governors within the province of Babylon. But now these last three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in particular, found themselves confronted with a major issue of conscience. An issue of conscience which threatened not only to wreck their careers, but to cost them their very lives. For Nebuchadnezzar, it seems, was abandoning his pluralist policy. By this compulsory act of worship, he was seeking to enforce a measure of religious uniformity on the whole empire. His motive for doing this, I think, was undoubtedly paranoid feelings of insecurity about the loyalty of his subjects. If you were here last week, we did detect evidence of this in his dream in chapter 2, and I suspect this golden obelisk was an attempt to dissolve those fears away by using religion as a political instrument. It's been done many times through the history of the world. By establishing an imperial cult, the people would be encouraged to invest superstitious devotion in the empire. And so rebellion against the emperor would not just be dangerous any longer, it would be also impious. Sociologists tell us that religion is usually a way of reinforcing the status quo. That's how Nebuchadnezzar tried to use it here. Nebuchadnezzar, however, in trying to deify the state in this way, was going a step too far for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. As believers in the God of the Bible, they couldn't worship anything or anyone except him. It wasn't that they weren't loyal servants of the emperor. On the contrary, the fact that they were believers almost certainly gave an integrity to their administration, which many other governors in those days would have lacked. But they could not render unconditional obeisance to Nebuchadnezzar or to his image, which is what worship is. When pressed, they had no alternative but to confess that the God of the Bible had a prior claim on their allegiance and sole claim on their worship. To worship anything or anyone other than him was to compromise the primary commitment of their lives. The government had gone too far, and they were left with no choice but to disobey it, therefore. And that brings us to the second movement in the story from verse 8 onwards. The dissidents who refused to conform. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. There are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you've set up. Now, I think it's worth noting that these three young men did not go out of their way to publicize this act of civil disobedience on their part. They didn't make any formal protests to the emperor about the image. They didn't volunteer the information. They weren't prepared to worship it. They even seemed to have succeeded in keeping their nonconformity reasonably secret. They hadn't caused any major scandal over the matter. They hadn't embarrassed the emperor, or he would have already known about the issue. But of course, when everybody else is falling down on their faces at unpredictable moments, it's difficult not to be conspicuous, isn't it? The nonconformity of these three young men had been spotted by some of the Chaldeans, the wise men who gave advice to the emperor. And unfortunately, these wise men were not sympathetic to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In part, it may have been anti-Semitic prejudice. But mainly, I suspect, their malice was generated by professional jealousy. For you remember back in chapter 2, Daniel, their patron, had won the emperor's favor by telling the emperor his dream, and in the process had humiliated all the other wise men in the court who weren't able to do it. These foreigners had only been promoted to the post they had as a result of Daniel's influence with the emperor, and they were foreigners, and they had been promoted, no doubt, over the heads of many more senior colleagues. Well, here was an opportunity to get their own back. There's one thing Nebuchadnezzar can't stand, it's insubordination, they said to themselves. Verse 13, furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Is it true, he says, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? I have little doubt Nebuchadnezzar felt he was being very generous in saying this. Enraged though he was, he clearly wanted to give these three men opportunity to get themselves off the hook. If it had been anybody else, one suspects it would have been a case of summary execution without permission to appeal. But for Daniel's friends, he was willing to give one more chance. But only one. If they persisted in allowing their petty nationalist superstition to interfere with his new policy of religious uniformity in the empire, well, so help me, he says, I'll carry out my threat of capital punishment. There's no way I can afford to leave my edict on this matter disregarded. Especially with all these international delegates around, it would defeat the whole object of the exercise. I can't demonstrate the slightest hint of weakness in this matter. The Babylonian state at this moment in time needs the absolute allegiance of every subject without qualification or condition. No deity, not even Daniel's, is going to get in the way of that. But unfortunately, these three young men just couldn't see it that way. In words that I think form the center of the whole story, they declare their uncompromising stand. Verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But notice these words. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. There are several things to notice from these verses. The first thing I want you to notice is that it represents a new dimension of courage in these men. It's one thing, after all, to defy the king in secret as a matter of private conscience. It's another thing altogether to defy the king to his face as an act of public testimony. Many, I think, would have been intimidated, wouldn't they, by this personal interview. Which of us hasn't trembled just at the thought of seeing the headmaster, or seeing the master of the college, or even seeing the pastor? It says much, doesn't it, for their nerve, that even face to face with this greatest man in the entire world, that's what he was, they were undaunted. They stood their ground. The second thing I want you to notice from these verses is that as far as they were concerned, the whole issue was an open and shut case. There was no need for reflection, they said. No room for debate, no possibility of any revision of their position. We do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. That's their reply. It comes very close, I think, to Cyprian's famous answer to the Roman emperor when he was similarly invited to offer divine worship to Caesar as Lord. He said, there can be no deliberation in a matter so sacred. In other words, it would be an insult to God even to attempt to defend oneself against a charge of this nature. There can be no possibility of evading the guilty verdict. A believer's response to idolatry, no matter how imperiously commanded, must be defiant refusal. He has no choice. It's an open and shut case. Now, this is significant. You see, it's far from impossible to imagine that some people would, in the position of these three, want to weigh up the pros and cons. After all, they might have said, we've been placed in this unique position of authority in the Babylonian Empire by divine providence, haven't we? It's clearly God's will that we should be governors of these provinces. It's clearly in the interest of the Jewish community that we remain there. So wouldn't it be a case of the lesser of two evils to perform this emperor's commandment? It's a small one. Surely expediency demands that we shouldn't throw our lives away over so trivial a matter. We are living in a pagan society, after all. Some compromise is inevitable. When in Rome, you have to do a bit as the Romans do, don't you? If they had entertained arguments of that sort, it wouldn't have been surprising. Many others in similar situations have done so. One recalls the notorious Vicar of Bray. You heard of him? Minister of a small Berkshire village during the reigns of Charles II and through to the accession of George I. A time, of course, when, not unlike Nebuchadnezzar, the Stuart monarchy was trying by an act of uniformity to enforce religious unity on the people of this country for political reasons. During his period in office, the Vicar of Bray changed his creed from Catholic to Protestant and back to Catholic again, with every wind of change in the monarchy. When asked at the end of his life why he had been so fickle, he replied it was to fulfill his greatest ambition in life. What's that, they asked? Why, he said, to live and die Vicar of Bray. There are no such inconsistencies observable in these three men. They don't need to weigh up the arguments. They see no point in trying to manufacture some excuse. They are guilty as charged. Believers in the God of the Bible could be nothing else in this situation. And that brings me to the third thing I want you to notice about this great reply of theirs, and that is their total trust in the sovereignty of God over their destiny. See how they put it. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, God is able to save us from it. But even if he does not, we will not worship the image of God. And that brings me to the third thing I want you to notice about this great reply of theirs, and that is their total trust in the sovereignty of God over their destiny. See how they put it. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, God is able to save us from it. But even if he does not, we will not worship the image of God. Now, Old Testament scholars here will know the Aramaic is a little bit ambiguous in verse 18, but I think there can be no doubt the NIV has got the only sense that really carries conviction here. These brave men are confessing not only their confidence in the adequacy of God's sovereign power should he choose to deliver them, but what is more remarkable, they're confessing their confidence in the wisdom of God's sovereign purpose should he choose not to do so. Important, isn't it? To my mind, it makes their testimony all the more commendable. I can imagine some super spiritual types, you know, seeing that conditional clause in verse 18 and interpreting it as a failure of faith. But even if he does not, surely an uncompromised faith wouldn't even consider the possibility of God not intervening miraculously in their defense. I've certainly heard people claiming supernatural healing in much of this mood, insisting that the sick should believe unconditionally God's going to restore them, and not to entertain any doubt on the subject. I've even heard people blaming the absence of miraculous healing upon a lack of faith. If we believed hard enough, he'd have answered our prayer. But you see, this isn't biblical religion, certainly not the religion of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. No, that's superstition. Superstition that treats the prayer of faith like some kind of magic spell, which puts divine power at our human disposal, which suggests that God has agreed to do what we say, whatever we say, provided we say it hard enough and believe it enough. It is not so. The God of the Bible is the king. He always exercises his power at his own discretion. And true faith is faith in his sovereignty. There was no lack of faith in the attitude of these three men, because they qualify their assurance with the phrase, "but even if he does not," any more than there was any lack of faith in Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he prefaced his prayer, "if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." See, the object of biblical faith is God in his sovereign power and God in his sovereign purpose. And it's the hallmark of true faith that it has equal confidence in both of those divine attributes, his power and his purpose. You recall the plea, perhaps, of the leper who came to Jesus, as recorded in the Gospel of Mark. "If you are willing, you can make me clean." See those two clauses? The main clause, the apodosis, expresses his confidence in Christ's power. "You can make me clean." But the conditional clause, the protasis, that expresses his confidence in Christ's purpose. "If you are willing." True faith, you see, never presumes upon the divine purpose. True faith always submits to the divine purpose. Even as Jesus did when he concluded that famous prayer in Gethsemane, "Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." Take a lesson then from those words, "but even if he does not." They're worth underlining in your Bible. For there are some of us who in our prayer lives do not have a "even if he does not" clause. And we're constantly victim to disillusionment and resentment because we don't have that clause in our prayer. For anybody who's praying for divine intervention in their life right now, make sure that clause is there. Put your trust fully in the adequacy of God's power. Of course you must. If necessary, he can move mountains to answer your prayer. But put your trust also in the wisdom of his purpose. For we are not always spared the fiery furnace, as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. And it was the mark of their faith that they recognized that. And that brings us to the third movement in the story, doesn't it? A God who is worth dying for. At verse 19. "Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated, 7 times hotter than usual. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace." It's a gruesome scene. Don't let the childhood sort of aroma of this take away from what a gruesome scene this is. An emperor so insane with rage, he drives his own soldiers to death in his determination to prevent this god, this alien god, from interfering in his plans. We would perhaps like to think that cruelty of this sort is the mark of primitive and uncivilized peoples. But a moment's thought shows us that isn't so. The Babylonian Empire was an enlightened one, far more so than the Assyrian Empire that preceded it. More liberal, more open-minded, more cultured, more civilized. And yet here is its emperor permanently supervising this grotesque atrocity. It's an anomaly, though, we could illustrate 100 times from history. The most barbaric torture has been inflicted by the most cultured of peoples. China is a civilization that goes back further than perhaps any other civilization on Earth. But as recent events in Peking have shown, when it finds itself confronted by dissidents, China can react just like Nebuchadnezzar did. Berlin in the 1930s was one of the great cultural capitals of the world. But as those unbelievable films from the concentration camps show, men who listen to Wagner can still put children in gas chambers. Nor should we in Britain think ourselves immune from judgment in this matter. It's only a matter of a few hundred years, even in this cradle of democracy that we are so proud of, that we were burning brave men and women at the stake ourselves for no other reason. And like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their religion did not conform. And what about the Jews themselves? Of all peoples on earth, they surely had the advantages of moral illumination. The people of the Bible, a people who had known themselves such persecution. You would think of all peoples on earth, they would have learned the folly of this kind of thing. But no, it was they of all people who cried, "Crucify him. Crucify him." Now, there's nothing unusual about religious dissidents being persecuted by the political arm. Nothing uncivilized about the fiery furnace. And nor will idealistic talk about freedom and democracy purge such instruments of terror from our world. There's only one thing can halt the megalomaniac cruelty of Nebuchadnezzar's. And that's the courage of people like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet. He asked his advisers, "Wasn't it three men we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Who was this fourth figure in the fire? The phrase "son of the gods" suggests that Nebuchadnezzar thought it was an angel, and perhaps he was right. But there's nothing actually in the text to prove that it was anything more than a vision which only Nebuchadnezzar himself could see. Older commentators, of course, used to speculate that it was a pre-incarnation appearance of Christ. And in a way, I don't think that opinion is to be despised. Because whether it was an angel or a vision, this fourth figure was certainly a personal representative of Emmanuel. God with us. One can't, I think, but remember the words of Isaiah, written to the exiles and certainly, I think, familiar to the narrator of this story. "Fear not, I have redeemed you. I've called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the fire, you will not be burned. I will be with you." I think it's important to understand the novelty of this kind of God to Nebuchadnezzar. See, the gods he was familiar with were remote celestial guardians of destiny, astrological deities. You could see them through a telescope, perhaps, but that was about as close as they got. And here was a God who was with his people, with them in power to comfort and to deliver them, even from a fiery furnace. Here's a God who's able to arrest the laws of thermodynamics and the process of combustion. "What God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" he demanded. How he regretted those impudent words now. What might such a God do to an arrogant emperor who threatens his servants? He approaches the opening of the blazing furnace and shouts, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out." And then when they emerge, with not even the smell of fire on them, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own. Therefore I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces." Poor old Nebuchadnezzar, he really was rather slow to learn, wasn't he? Did he really think he could recoup his imperial pride by being as intensely vindictive towards Jew haters as he had been towards the Jews themselves? Once again, there's something rather comic about the scene, if it weren't so bloody. Yet at least this proud man had learned something. At least he had learned that there was a God Most High a God he couldn't ignore, a God who took priority over every human monarchy. And that's the vital lesson of the passage. It's the lesson Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego want us to learn. There is a God who reigns, who has an absolute claim on our allegiance, and who takes priority over every other human authority. What difference does believing that make to a person at the end of the 20th century? It makes a lot of difference. It makes a difference, first of all, to our attitude to government and to politics. For it means, you see, that there is a limit on legitimate government power. I think there's a tendency for many of us in the West to think that the test of moral acceptability for a regime has to do with how democratic it is. Is it elected? Is there an opposition? And so on. That isn't the Bible's attitude. What legitimizes a government in the Bible is not the method of its appointment, but rather the way it perceives its own authority. Godly governments, whether they be monarchies or republics or even military dictatorships, godly governments see themselves as accountable institutions. Accountable, that is, to a higher law than they themselves represent. They have no title to absolutize themselves. They cannot demand the unconditional obedience of their subjects. For there is an authority higher than theirs to which appeal can be made. That was where Nebuchadnezzar went wrong. It's where countless governments in our century have gone wrong too. And interestingly, you can often tell which governments have gone wrong on this point by their public symbols. Nebuchadnezzar's obelisk in the plain of Dura finds its echo, for instance, in the huge posters of Hitler in Germany during the last war. In those huge pictures of Stalin and Lenin that we see in the big marches in the USSR. In the huge busts of Mao that adorn Peking. Yes, and in Nkrumah's Ghana. And in Khomeini's Tehran. They're always there, aren't they? Huge pictures of the ruler. Huge symbols of the national idolatry. It is surely significant that John tells us in the book of Revelation that it is the mark of the beast that he demands men worship his image. When any government institutes political idolatry in that way, like Nebuchadnezzar, they have gone too far. They have exceeded the proper mandate God gives to civil government. No human government can claim absolute authority in the civil sphere. To do so is to deify the state. It is to breach the first commandment. It is to deny the moral accountability of man to his maker. Of course, there are ways of hindering the rise of that kind of regime. Wise countries have their bills of rights, which enshrine the limits on government power to prevent the emergence of that kind of absolutism. Democracies have elections, which at least force the regime to exhibit some kind of accountability to the people, if not to God. But we make a grave mistake, you know, if we think there is any infallible constitutional safeguard against the rise of politicized idolatry. Bills of rights can be ignored. Said Hans Frank, our constitution is the will of the Führer. And sometimes even democracies can elect absolutist governments, as Hitler was elected into power. The Nebuchadnezzars of this world, even with their images, are not necessarily unpopular. Now, the only guarantee against this kind of things lies in the self-restraint of government itself. There is no other guarantee. And the only remedy lies in the courage of dissidents who will not conform. That brings me to the second important lesson for the 20th century of this great truth, that there is a sovereign God in heaven who calls all governments to account. It means that in some situations in life, civil disobedience is necessary. Notice that, I say necessary. Verse 28, they trusted in God and defied the king's command. Now, of course, political theorists have debated for centuries why we ought to obey a government and under what circumstances it's legitimate to disobey a government. I don't intend to get embroiled in that argument today. I'm not talking about revolution and whether it's right or wrong. Suffice it to say this morning, there is a time when men and women of God not only may legitimately disobey a government, but must do so, and have no choice in the matter. And that is when that government makes demands which directly contradict the law of God or challenge his supreme authority over their lives. When any state does that, it is usurping the place of God in their affections, and the Bible will not allow that. No matter how subtle the argument is, no compromise on such an issue is defensible. It is a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, an open and shut case. A believer has no alternative in such circumstances but to say no. Indeed, we, who live in the Christian era, have a higher duty to say no than even Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. For as our reading in Acts 17 reminds us, we no longer live in the era when God shuts his eye to the idolatries of pagan nations. We live in the day when the kingdom of God is being proclaimed to all peoples, when God calls all people everywhere to repent. And that means that silent protest for us will not be enough, that secret discipleship for us will not be enough. Now we have a duty to denounce every idolatry that arrogantly rises its head against the kingdom of God, the sovereignty of Christ. That means, you see, that Christian mission is bound to have political implications. It's got to have political implications. Anybody who believes in the kingdom of God must necessarily deny to the state that absolute authority in the civil realm which an absolutist state seeks to exert. But more than that, it means there are certain kinds of political regime where it may be the only place where a man or woman of God can exist with integrity is in prison or on the scaffold. Those are serious words. I don't say them lightly. But I believe it is important that you and I know it is so. For any weakness in our stand on this point will leave us vulnerable in the hour of trial. It's all too easy to find ourselves like cowardly Vicar of Bray, sacrificing our integrity and our consistency for the sake of expediency and survival. What was it Dante said? The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in times of great moral crisis try to maintain their neutrality. There can be no neutrality over this. There are times when, like Peter, we must declare, we obey God rather than men. But notice, will you, when a Christian dissident makes such a stand, it's never in the name of some alternative ideology. We have no biblical right to disobey the government simply because it's not democratic enough for our taste, or socialist enough for a taste, or capitalist enough for our taste, come to that. Now, when a Christian disobeys the state, it must always be, not in the name of the sovereignty of the people, but in the name of the sovereignty of God, whose majesty the state impugns. That's why a Christian must sometimes say no. That's why sometimes civil disobedience is necessary. And I say frankly, this country in particular has much to be grateful for to brave Christian souls who in centuries past have eschewed the easy path of compromise and safety and, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, defied the king's command rather than compromise their consciences. The question we have to ask ourselves is whether that spirit still exists within us as a people at the end of the 20th century, for I have my doubts. In this secular society in which we live, in this pluralist society in which we live, I'm not sure we believe in anything enough to die for it any longer. Martin Niemöller, a Christian who suffered under Hitler, expressed his own sense of failure like this. In Germany, they came first for the communists. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics. I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me. And by that time, there was no one left to speak up. Now, make no mistake about it. It is not the British Constitution which will deliver us from Nebuchadnezzar's of the future. It is the brave defiance of dissident nonconformists. And in the 21st century, we may very well have need of them again. So I ask you the question we began with. Is there anything in your life worth dying for? There was in the case of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, wasn't there? We will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold, even if we are thrown into the blazing furnace. Like them, we have no guarantee of miraculous interventions to save us if we ever make such a stand. All we can do is trust in the adequacy of God's power to deliver us, should he choose to do so, and in the wisdom of his purpose, should he not choose to do so. We're offered no guarantees. Indeed, when one looks at the history of the church, it's rare that God has miraculously delivered his people. More often, it's been a case of be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Think of the way those early Christians bore the loss of their wealth, the loss of their reputation, the loss of their freedom, the loss even of their lives, sometimes mutilated and tortured in the gladiatorial arena. That's what they were like. They didn't get out of death. They had to be faithful unto death. We talk so smugly about loving God, don't we? But what does it really mean for us to say we love God? I suspect that for too many of us, loving God means a warm, cozy glow when we're singing jolly choruses at the Kikyu meeting. Or an orgy of emotional sentimentality when we're listening to a particularly powerful sermon. Now, the word love in the Bible means, first and foremost, loyalty, allegiance, commitment. When we say we love God, that's what it ought to mean. Commitment. Commitment to a cause worth dying for. Commitment to a cause, to a truth that has an unconditional claim upon our loyalty. And that is what Jesus offers you and me. That's why Christianity is exciting at the end of the 20th century, in our decadent, anemic, apathetic Western society. There are no causes left worth dying for. Except Jesus. And we need a cause. Oh yes, we need a cause. To be a human being, we need a cause. With no such cause at the core of our lives, moral heroism is impossible for us. We are reduced to those men without chests we talked about. And Christ is not looking for the foolhardy bravado of a daredevil who risks his life for nothing. is offering to us the sober courage of the martyr who is willing to risk his life for everything. He offers us something to live and die for. And there is no middle ground in that. We are either potential martyrs or potential suicides. For if this morning you and I have nothing worth dying for, we have nothing worth living for either.